Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. We're a venue for spoken word presentations in many forms. We feature writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm your host, John O'Brien. Last year around this time, a time when many of us looked to relax with a good book in a pleasant spot, away from the usual chatter of life, a time when Town Hall takes a month off for goodness sake, for a well-earned break, and to avoid overheating its guests, Speakers Forum was offered a copy of a presentation given at something called the Smoke Farm Symposium. In the talk, a young man named Blaise Aguera Yarkas, a software designer working on machine intelligence, spoke fascinatingly about the future of artificial intelligence. And we were hooked. Smoke Farm is a program center and events venue run by the Seattle-based nonprofit Rubicon Foundation. The farm is located north of Arlington on the banks of the Stillaguamish River. The Smoke Farm Symposium brings together an eclectic group of speakers for a day of presentations and discussion. It is curated by Professor Stuart Smithers of the University of Puget Sound and Brendan Kiley, a staff writer and editor at The Stranger. So this year we ventured up north ourselves to record a whole day of talks at the 7th annual Smoke Farm Symposium. The talks take place in an open-air barn on the 365-acre farm. Lunch and dinner are served, this year by Seattle chef Monica Demas and her mom. In the next few weeks, we'll present more talks, but one that stood out was given by Sheldon Solomon, a professor of social psychology at Skidmore College. Solomon is the co-author, with Jeff Greenberg and Tom Pazinski, of The Worm at the Core, on the role of death in life. Based on experimental research, the authors explore how the fear of death, conscious and unconscious, affects human behavior. Their work sheds light on how our understanding of our mortality has impacted human evolution and history, from religion and art to science and politics. Sheldon Solomon spoke at Smoke Farm Symposium 7 on Saturday, August 22, 2015. Here, Stuart Smithers makes the introductions.
Somebody was talking to me at lunch, like, how do we select people for the symposium? And it is a mysterious process. It usually begins in January. And Brendan Kiley and I go to Cafe Press. We order a warm meal, like a cassoulet or something like that, and a carafe of wine. And then we usually talk for about 15 minutes about how we're behind schedule again, that we really should have had this worked out. And then we start discussing the names that we've sort of had from our list previously. And then there'll be lots of comments like, oh, but Bethany would never allow that, or we really have to think about this. So it goes on. But truly, I mean, that actually is the process. But we also ask past presenters, and we've been very lucky to have people make suggestions. But it's also all of our friends and all of you, if you have good ideas and suggestions about who would be a great speaker here, we're all ears. And we will approach that at our January lunch. So don't hesitate to send us your ideas. And I mention that because that's exactly how Sheldon Solomon got here. One of our close friends knew Sheldon's work and suggested him. We have the miracle of the YouTube, so we can check people out and think a little bit about it. We didn't have to think very long. And Sheldon was one of our earliest invitees. And as I said, it was really rather remarkable. It was like, I think it was like a half a day, and Sheldon said, great, I'm coming. So it was a sort of a happy marriage. And he among the things that he's notable for, he's a professor of psychology, including a distinguished Ross professor at Skidmore College. As many of you know, his topic is on death, and it's not unconnected at all to the work of Ernst Becker, which is one of those classic texts, you know, the denial of death that everybody, you know, must have read. And if you haven't, sorry, that's kind of the guilt trip thing. You should read it because you really can't keep up with, like, Woody Allen movies and things if you haven't read The Denial of Death, at a minimum, right? So among his works is one of the more recent ones, In the Wake of 9/11, The Psychology of Terror, and that comes on the heels of earlier work on terror management theory and interesting ideas, obviously related to death in some perspective as well. But I think we're going to have a slightly different presentation today. He's also... And I appreciate this as a teacher. He's a legendary teacher. People write about him and appreciate his presence and his vitality and humor and way of staying engaged and communicating. So please welcome Sheldon Solomon. Thank you, Sheldon.
Thank you, Stuart and Brendan, for doing this. It did take me all of a minute when I saw the email come to Smoke Farm. I was like, all right, farm, smoke, good combination. I'll be there, and had no idea beyond that what the symposium might be like, except I've seen enough, both of the surroundings and the other speakers and just the good cheer, as well as very able and thoughtful questions on the part of the folks that sit before me to know that I think this is an awesome event, and I thank everybody for being here. Although I do have to piss and moan a bit after a great lunch. I don't know about you, but siesta time. So so I'm not too happy about being the non-pharmacological intervention for insomnia, but anyway, I'll do my best. As Stuart mentioned, I've spent the most of my professional life, and then as I think about it, probably a good chunk of my personal life, just ruminating on the consequences of people arguably being the only form of life that are starkly aware of the fact that we will someday die. And for centuries, maybe a millennium, as far back as we have recorded records, you know, people, philosophers, theologians, and more recently social and physical scientists have tried to articulate, well, what's the essence of being a human being? And of course, some of you are familiar with the notion of Homo sapiens, this idea that we're wise and rational creatures. Although, if you watch Fox News, I wouldn't want to have to be on the side of the debating team to defend that proposition as a wholesale description of our lot. But that's not the only depiction. There's, I'm sure some of you are familiar with Homo ludens, the idea that we're fundamentally playful creatures. Maybe Homo aestheticus, the idea that we're fundamentally artistic creatures. What else do we got? Homo faber, the idea that we're tool-making, working creatures. And I think all of those conceptions of humanity have great heuristic value. And what I'd like to do today is to just pop another one on the proverbial conceptual table. I'll call it Homo mortalis, following a dead Scottish essayist, Alexander Smith, who I think in 1857 or so wrote that it is our knowledge that we must die that makes us human. And a couple of decades later, William James, the great philosopher, wrote the first psychology book in 1890. He referred to death as the worm at the core of the human experience. Same idea Smith framed in biblical terms. And then, as Stuart mentioned, 1973, fast forward a couple of decades, well, almost a century, Ernest Becker wins a Pulitzer Prize in 1973 for his book, The Denial of Death, where he elaborates on these ideas in great detail from an evolutionary existential psychodynamic perspective. And so that's what I'd like to tell you a little bit about today, Becker's ideas and some of the work that we've done. I'm a research egghead, basically. I'm an experimental social psychologist by trade, and I accidentally bumped into Becker's books in my first year as a professor at Skidmore College in 1980, and I called up my buddies Jeff Greenberg, now at the University of Arizona, and Tom Pazinski, now at the University of Colorado, and I was like, you have to read This is really important ideas. All right. In a nutshell, classic comic book overview of Ernest Becker, what he asks us to do is to start with what I hope is the relatively non-controversial Darwinian assumption that human beings share with all forms of life a basic predisposition towards survival in the service of self-preservation, but especially reproduction. But Darwin and Becker go on to point out that humans are arguably unique by virtue of our enlarged forebrain, which confers upon us the capacity to think abstractly and symbolically to an amazing degree, where we can imagine things that do not yet exist and then have the audacity to render those dreams concrete. I like Otto Rank, one of Becker's favorites, who said, "Only human beings make the unreal real." And I'm sure some of you who've seen Leonardo da Vinci's pictures of helicopters drawn like in the 1500s, and people are like, that's crazy. And yet here we are today, routinely transported by what was originally denounced as the doodlings of a madman, and clearly the sublime capacity to alter the world in accordance with our desires is highly adaptive. However, it also leads, says Becker, and now he goes back in time from Darwin to Soren Kierkegaard, to the realization that we exist. In the 1840s, Kierkegaard, way ahead of his time, points out that human beings are so smart that we literally realize that we're here. And what I usually do, except I don't want to risk it right after lunch, I usually say to people, who's aware of the fact that you're not only here, but you know that you're here pretending to listen to me while you ruminate about what we're going to have for dinner? And usually everybody's like, okay, I know that I'm here. But the point that Kierkegaard makes is we take consciousness or self-awareness for granted, when in fact it takes a ridiculously sophisticated cognitive apparatus to, in Kierkegaard's language, render ourselves the objects of our own subjective inquiry. And in a very little book called Fear and Trembling, anybody know that book? Buy it for your in-laws, coffee table book. What Kierkegaard says is that if you're smart enough to know that you exist, you will necessarily experience two uniquely human emotions that he describes as awe and dread, respectively. And I think those terms are fairly self-explanatory. All right, but let's talk for 15 seconds about how awesome it is to be alive before we get to the dreadful part of it. Who's ever woken up one day just happy to be alive? You ever have? You didn't win the lottery. You didn't win $1 million. No Nobel Prize. You just wake up on a day like this. You see a tree, you see a bird, you see somebody you've never met before, and you smile, and you just is like, yeah, life is good. Who knows or pretends to know James Joyce's Ulysses? Anybody ever get through that book? All right, well, if you know how the last sentence of the book is 50 pages, no punctuation. I wish I could get away with that, but it didn't help me. And yes, there you go. Yes, there you go. Thank you, sir. So the sentence, the longest sentence in English literature, starts and ends with the simple affirmation of what makes it, I think, most joyfully exuberant about being a human being, and that's the sublime appreciation that arises from the mere fact that we exist. Hold on to that, because Kierkegaard turns right around and says, yeah, but unless you're a child or lobotomized or neurologically impaired, if you're smart enough to know that you exist, then you're necessarily shackled with the existential baggage that arises from the realization that, like all living things, your life is of relatively finite duration, which is just my diplomatic way of saying that you too will someday die. And not only will you die, but many of you, I hope everybody, is smart enough to recognize that your death can occur at any time for reasons that you could never anticipate or control. That's Kierkegaard. And then Becker, just to give us a metaphorical knee in the groin, following Freud, points out it's not only that you know that you're going to die, it's not only that you know that you could walk outside and get smote by a meteor, but you also know that, as far as we can tell, you permanently ensconced in a physical carcass that, like all living things, will decay and eventually expire. In other words, you're an animal. Who did the Elephant Man film. Anybody know that film where the Elephant Man's like, I am not an animal? And you're like, go, Mr. Pachyderm. But the thing is, he's wrong. And so too are we when we deny the fact that from a purely biological point of view, we are no more fundamentally significant than either lizards or potatoes. And the point that Becker makes is that if that's all we thought about, I'm going to die. I could die any time. I'm a cold cut with an attitude. I'm Spam with a plant, but I don't have a can. I'm pate with panache. Stop me. I grew up in New Jersey. I have a lot of these. All right, but I digress. We're on the clock. Where's Brendan? Where's the timekeeper? All right, anyway, the point is, if that's all we thought about, wouldn't be able to stand up in the morning. We would literally be overwhelmed with paralyzing existential terror that what Becker proposes, we manage quite unconsciously through the construction and maintenance of what the anthropologists call culture. According to Becker, culture consists of humanly constructed beliefs about the nature of reality that we share with human beings in a group to minimize death anxiety by giving us each a sense that we're valuable participants in a meaningful universe. I know you're a smart lot, so let me stipulate that this is not the only function of culture, but it is a very essential one. And what Becker points out in defense of this proposition is that, as far as we can tell, all cultures offer us an account of the origin of the universe. All cultures offer us a blueprint for appropriate conduct, the satisfaction of which enables us to consider ourselves persons of value in a world of meaning, and all cultures offer some hope of immortality, either literally through the heavens, afterlives, souls, and reincarnations of the world's great religions, or symbolically going back to the ancient Greeks who said, well, we may not be here forever, but we're still comforted by the fact that some vestige of ourselves will remain nonetheless. For some of us, it's from having children. For some, it's by producing great works of art or science. For others, it's like amassing great fortunes and putting our name on our airplanes and buildings and casinos. Trump. More on that later. Anyway, so that's basically what Ernest Becker says. And so two questions. Question number one is, well, so what? What do these ideas do for us in terms of explanatory power? And question number two, is it true? How do we know that these ideas are true? When I first bumped into Ernest Becker in the early 1980s, I was so excited about this that Jeff and Tom and I wrote a paper for the American Psychologist, which is our big like flagship journal, where we basically we wrote about what I just said, and we were so excited. And then 6 months later, the paper was rejected with a one-sentence review. The reviewer said, I have no doubt that these ideas are of no interest whatsoever to any psychologist alive or dead. I was like, wow. It's like, wow. I guess they didn't care for it. So anyway, then the editor pulled us aside at a conference, and he's like, yo, dudes, you're experimental social psychologists. If these ideas have any merit, then why don't you try producing some evidence in support of them? And I was like, oh, wow, I knew my degree would come in handy. This is nothing to be proud of, but I got a PhD unscathed by knowledge by being taught a very sophisticated methodology. And I was like, all right, I have a method in search of a question. So now we finally found a question. And so what I'm going to do is to glob those two things together, so what, and how do we know these ideas are true, by just trotting through a somewhat abridged laundry list of various phenomena that I think are comprehensible through this lens that I've presented so far. All right, the first thing that we were interested in is man's proverbial inhumanity to man? Why is it that people can't get along with other human beings who don't share their beliefs about reality? Why is it that even the most benevolent glance at human history reveals an ongoing succession of genocidal atrocities juxtaposed with the brutal subjugation of designated in-house inferiors? And what Becker says is that there's two reasons for that. Reason number one is that if your beliefs about the nature of reality serve to reduce death anxiety, then the mere existence of people who are different is problematic, because if you grant the validity of an alternative conception of reality, you necessarily undermine the confidence with which you subscribe to your own beliefs, and in so doing, expose yourself to the very anxiety your beliefs were erected to mitigate in the first place. I only have one other. Did that idea make sense? Because I stopped listening to myself, so I hope it did. All right, so that's thing number one. The mere existence of people who are different is discombobulating, whether we're aware of it or not. Idea number two from Becker's book, Escape from Evil, even more discombobulating. And the idea comes from William James, and that is that our symbols, our religious symbols, our political symbols, our economic symbols are all very, very powerful, but they're nevertheless symbolic, where death is a very real physical event. And what Becker argues is that no symbol is ever powerful enough to completely eradicate death anxiety. Therefore, there will always be what he called a panic rumbling beneath the surface of consciousness. There's always going to be death anxiety there. And here he goes psychodynamic. And what he says is we repress that death anxiety and we project it onto other groups of individuals that we declare to be the all-encompassing repositories of evil, the eradication of which would make life on earth as it's purported to be in heaven. And the point that he makes is that we need somebody to hate. And if we don't have people conveniently around to serve those purposes, we will designate them as such. Who's familiar with Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own, where Virginia Woolf says, if we needed to, we will hate someone for the shape of their nose or the color of their shirt. Well, the point that Becker makes is that when we run into people who are different or when we declare them to be different, well, the first thing that we do is to denigrate or derogate them. And then while we do that, we try to get them to dispose of their ideas and adopt ours at the same time. And if that doesn't work, just kill those people, thus proving that your God or our God is better than theirs. My God is better than your God, and we will kick your ass to prove it. And the point that Becker makes is that while this is by no means a comprehensive account of prejudice and ethnic discord, that one of the root causes of our ongoing inability to get along with people who are different is that we cannot tolerate the existence of alternative death-denying ideologies. All right, how do we know this is true? This is where Jeff and Tom and I come in. We developed a very simple paradigm. We call it the mortality salience paradigm. And the logic is very simple. If these ideas have merit, then let's randomly assign some people to think about themselves dying, and let's randomly assign other people to think about something unpleasant but not fatal. You're having a root canal and they ran out of anesthetic. You're in a car accident and they had to amputate your leg. You're given a speech and you puke on the podium and everyone is horrified and ostracizes you. And so we manipulate what we call mortality salience in a variety of ways. Sometimes we just ask people in an open-ended questionnaire, think about your thoughts and feelings associated with dying. Sometimes we show them gory images of an electrocution or an autopsy. Sometimes we're a little bit more subtle. We go outdoors and we stop some people in front of a funeral parlor and other people 100 meters on either side. Sometimes we're extraordinarily subtle, and what we do is use what we call subliminal death primes. We have people working on a computer, and we flash the word death so rapidly, 28 milliseconds, that you can't see that that you've been exposed to anything. Back to the great talk that we had earlier about the fact that the mind attends to much more than what we can be aware of at any given time. All of the findings that I'm about to blubber about have been obtained with each of these manipulations of what we call mortality salience. All right, well, what do we know? When Christians are reminded of their mortality, they like fellow Christians more, and they dislike Jews a great deal. When Germans are reminded of their mortality, they sit closer to other Germans. They sit further away from people who appear to be foreign. When Iranians are reminded of their mortality, they become more supportive of suicide bombing and more willing to become a martyr themselves. Americans, being very pragmatic, are not about to blow themselves up, but we're certainly happy to blow other people up. When we remind Americans of their mortality, they are more supportive of the use of nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons against countries who pose no direct threat to us. There's literally hundreds of these studies. They've been conducted by independent researchers in more than 20 countries on five continents. These effects have been obtained in children as young as 9 or 10 and in elderly folks as old as 80 or 85. I say that not to brag, but to establish that these are robust and replicable findings. And I like how George Bernard Shaw puts it when he said, I think it's in Heartbreak Hotel, when the angel of death sounds his trumpet, the pretenses of civilization are blown from men's heads into the mud like hats in a gust of wind. All right, what else can this help us understand? Who knows Max Weber, the dead German sociologist? What Weber said is that when in difficult historical times, when the psychological hits the fan, that people often become strangely attracted to what he called charismatic leaders, seemingly larger than life people who often proclaim that they've been divinely ordained to rid the world of evil. So who remembers that Hitler was elected, sort of, under very difficult times? Who also remembers the striking popularity of President George W. Bush following the events of September 11th? All right, one possibility is that Americans became more supportive of the president because he all of a sudden began to do a good job. I don't think that's the case. Another possibility is that the events of September 11th constituted a glaring reminder of one's mortality that led Americans across the political spectrum to embrace someone who literally said after 9/11 that he thought that he had been chosen by God to rid the world of evil at this difficult time. We did a boatload of studies about this, but the most profound one, right before the presidential election of 2004. We got registered voters who intended to vote in New Jersey. We randomly divided them into two groups. One group was asked to think about their mortality. The other group was asked to think about something unpleasant but not fatal. And then we just said, secret ballot, write down on a piece of paper who you're going to vote for. What we found is that in the control condition, Americans said they intended to vote for Senator John Kerry by a 4-1 margin. However, the participants reminded of their mortality said that they intended to vote for President Bush by an almost 3-1 margin. None of the participants, when we asked them if a death reminder would have altered their political predilections, they're like, that's outrageous. Your stupid questionnaire could in no way have influenced the outcome of the election. Hey, let's keep going. Brendan, five? Five, I got it. I'm going to do it. Let's speed talk. Well, I already am. Now I'm going to sound like an auctioneer, but let's wrap it up on time. All right, next thing. Existential concerns alienate us from nature, and that alienation from nature in turn causes us to on the planet, if you'll pardon the profanity. John Locke, in a second treatise on government, pointed out that anything in nature is of finite duration. And therefore, that was a psychological impetus for the construction of supernature. If we were happy with nature, we would just leave it at that. And sure enough, when people are reminded of their mortality, they take issue with the claim that humans are animals. When humans are reminded of their mortality, they have more negative attitudes towards animals and support killing them for reasons other than food and medical research. When people are reminded of their mortality, they prefer landscape lawns to actual nature. When people are reminded of their mortality, they become more greedily exploitative in forest simulation games where they're told if you cut down too many trees, there's not going to be any. All right. Inextricably connected to the idea that existential concerns undermine our care for the environment is the idea that they also magnify mindless and conspicuous consumption. At the end of the denial of death, Ernest Becker said, well, you know, human beings for the most part, or Americans for the most part, spend most of their days either drinking or shopping, which he says is the same thing. And so in accord with that view, I'll spare you the details, but I think there are reasons for this. Take a look at the back of a dollar bill if you have time. In a country that values the separation of church and state, on the back of the dollar is "In God We Trust." Look at the left, and then pass the dollar on to me, is a pyramid with the top of it detached with an eyeball. Joseph Campbell says that's an ancient Egyptian symbol of immortality. And sure enough, you remind people of their death. They have higher fiscal aspirations. They have a greater desire for high-status luxury items like a Lexus or a Rolex. If you ask them to draw coins or paper money, they actually draw bigger pictures of them. People reminded of death drink more alcohol and smoke more cigarettes if they're predisposed to drink or smoke. All right, one last thing, and I'll almost stop, maybe. This also helps us understand why America is a petri dish of psychopathology. National Institute of Mental Health points out that 12% of Americans are currently depressed. About 20 to 30% of Americans will be depressed at some point in their lives. These epidemic levels of depression are historically unprecedented. And according to Ernest Becker, whenever a large chunk of society is demoralized and disillusioned, we need to wonder whether or not the standards of value that are espoused by the culture are realistically attainable by the average individual. And what Becker points out is that we live in a world where we glorify power in the form of money and physical beauty in the form of unattainable thinness for women and staying young forever, and teaching our kids to strive for standards that are realistically unattainable is a recipe for psychological despair. All right, so in conclusion, this is not a particularly favorable view of humanity, but I like what Thomas Hardy said, that if a way to the better there be, it comes from taking a close look at the worst. And so what I would say, just to really annoy you, is that malignant manifestations of death anxiety bring the worst out in us. They make us depressed, hate-mongering, proto-fascists, plundering the planet in our insatiable desire for money and stuff as we wallow in an alcohol, drug, television, Facebook stupor. No. Why are you clapping? That's not good. All right. That's really not good. And maybe read the Jared Diamond dude in the book, what is it, Collapse, Why Societies Choose to Succeed or Fail. All right, the bad news is I think if things go as they currently are, we may be the first form of life to have the ignominious distinction of being directly responsible for our extinction. On the other hand, let me end on a high note. And this is a point that you made last night, Mott. I think it was at dinner, and that is that human beings have a pretty good track record so far of extricating ourselves from serious difficulties if we understand what it is that is provoking them in the first place. For a long time, we thought that plague was caused by bacteria. We thought it was caused by evil spirits. And when we did, so I got too modern too fast. When we did, we didn't make any progress. But then we learned that it's caused by bacteria. get antibiotics, modern medicine. Things have been a lot better ever since. And so, you know, the hope here is literally that perhaps once we fully recognize the role that mortal terror plays in human affairs, we can deploy our tremendous ingenuity towards counteracting the destructive potential that our deepest fears often provoke. So let me leave you with one thought. Albert Camus, I know some of you know his works, and in his notebooks he said, "Come to terms with death, thereafter anything is possible." Maybe too strong a statement, but not a bad one at least to try to approximate. So thank you very much. Let me say one more thing before I forget. I hope that I know some of you all are familiar with Ernest Becker's ideas, but if you're new to this, I just want to point out that for 25 years or so, there's been a nonprofit foundation based in Seattle. It's called the Ernest Becker Foundation. Deborah Jacobs, former Skidmore student, Seattle resident, is the new executive director of the foundation. Not trying to sell you anything except to maybe engage your interest. A lot of events in and around Seattle. The foundation is devoted to the dissemination of these ideas and the maybe naively optimistic service of hopefully promoting personal growth and fostering social progress. I think there's a good way of spending some time, and I hope that I'll see you all again at some of these things. I know I'm coming back to Town Hall in Seattle in January, and I'll try and bring pants because it'll be the winter. All right, now questions. Thank you. Sir, let's do the mic, please. Yeah, because I know they're trying to gather this. Sir.
So you mentioned that this death and anxiety is essentially insurmountable to some degree, right? So when you talk about how we essentially coerce nature to do our bidding to mitigate this anxiety, you don't quite speak as to whether that's inherently good or bad. So when we view, I guess, the things around us naturally, is it essentially okay to view them as that the value that derives from them is the value we get in mitigating our death anxiety? Or do they have their own inherent value that we need to respect just by default?
Yeah, the latter. All right. And no, good point, sir. So two things. One is that death anxiety, I don't think it's going to go away, and I don't think it would be a good idea if it did. Because think about it. Any living thing that readily acquiesced to the prospect of its own demise would be eradicated from the gene pool in relatively short order. Moreover, it's not death anxiety per se that causes problems. It's the repression of death anxiety when we bury it under the psychological bushes and it bears proverbial bitter fruit thereafter that is the difficulty. And so we are naturally consumers. No one likes to hear this, but we're natural born killers. If you eat meat, you know that. If you're a vegetarian, that carrot was doing fine before you unceremoniously yanked it out of the ground. If you're like my sister wearing a bed sheet in California and you only eat it off, it falls off the trees. When you walked across the lawn to get the apple that fell on the ground, you slaughtered countless organisms. And so I don't think there's anything inherently problematic about transacting with nature in the service of survival. Having said that, though, I think it is inherently problematic when we take the extraordinarily anthropomorphic position that we're created in God's image and are given domination over all that walks, crawls, and flies, and that some of our cavalier disregard from nature is a result of that. And by the way, this is not a slam on religion. Who saw the Pope step up for the world, and who saw this the declaration by the Islamic clerics saying we got to get off fossil fuels by 2050. So none of what I said here today is meant to be a cynical denunciation of religion. Any worldview that can give enough of us a sense of meaning and value and do so without unduly harming others, I'm all for that, be it religious or secular. Sir?
I'm going to make a little bit of a leap, and you can correct me if my leap. Understanding is wrong. So the way I understood it was that, you know, people who are primed with the fear of death, they tend to become a little more violent. There are other instincts which come up. culture helps them deal or interpret that in one way or the other, and somehow the society as a whole is going to make some actions. So I was wondering, have you actually noticed that cultures where lifespan is longer? So in my family, I haven't experienced a whole lot of death. Does that make me less violent as a person? That was my first question.
Okay. I don't know. Good question, an empirical one. Did everyone hear the question? That's an awesome question. By the way, most of our research comes from thoughtful questions like these. So that would be a good question, the extent to which one's expected life expectancy and direct experience with death, traumatic or not, influences these phenomena. Good question. I'll come back. Yeah.
The second question is, does the fear of death also cause us to go to the moon and go to the Mars?
Absolutely.
So there's also like positive implications from the fear of death.
Well, oh, okay. I don't know if it's so positive that we're going to ship everyone from Arkansas to the moon or Mars. All right, now, but sidestepping that for the moment, I wish we had more time because it sure seemed like I was proposing that death anxiety has uniformly and unilaterally negative effects. And, of course, that's only half the story. I think existential concerns at the same time bring out what is finest and most noble in us. And let's remember that, and let's talk about that afterwards. That's an excellent point, though.
Hey, so when you said that I might be able to influence your research with my questions,
go.
I had to stand up and ask. when you mentioned that all cultures have this certain mechanic of symbolism that mediates our awareness of death, I had to stop and say, okay, all cultures is a very big statement.
Yeah.
And to sort of extrapolate to our relationship with nature, I feel like, you know, there are cultures that have ritualized Gnostic practices for relating to death in an experiential way that are rites of passage that we don't have, and I'm kind of curious if your research has taken that into account, because often those cultures are the ones that are not the ones destroying the planet, you know?
Yeah. All right, so you got me. I knew this was a savvy lot, and every time I said all, I'm like, there's going to be some bastard that's actually listening. We'll point out that that's not quite true. So you're quite right. We're studying Buddhist monks right now in Asia and finding that they do not respond defensively to death reminders in the same way that folks do in other countries. Similarly, I think cross-cultural work, despite the fact that I was pontificating about these findings being obtained in a variety of countries, they're still relatively industrial ones. And so there's very fine researchers that are now getting to that with so-called indigenous peoples. There's another group that are studying the people in India that burn the bodies in that town where they're just surrounded by death imagery. So like all these good thoughts, and not to sound defensive, because we spent the last 30 years just establishing empirically that these death reminders produce robust effects. And now the real work starts, which is in Thomas Kuhn's language, normal science. Now we got to figure out the parameters, individual differences, particular situations that modulate these effects. What's the time course? What's the underlying neuroanatomical substrate of these findings? And we know a little bit, but not yet enough. So I'll just applaud the question. Take another one.
I think this is related to both the previous questions, but there is the alternative community response of sort of coming together as
Absolutely.
A society under periods of stress. And why does one thing happen and not the other? How can you trigger that other thing?
Yeah, okay. That's one of these. If I could answer that, I'd be chugging rum out of a coconut with my Nobel Prize on the beach. Because, no, and you make a fine point. There's Amin Maalouf wrote a book called Violence, something like Violence and the Need to Belong in the Name of Identity, where Maalouf says, you know, if we can't get out of this kind of historical tribal mentality of us versus them, we're doomed. And what we have to do is to recognize that any two people on Earth if they were to sit next to each other long enough, you'd probably realize that you have something in common. And as you know, and as all the scientists know in the room, humankind is a remarkably homogeneous, almost inbred population. Any two humans on the planet are closer related genetically than any two primates sitting next to each other on a hill in Africa. And so what we've done, and I hope this is just a start, and it may sound silly, we call it a common humanity prime. So in some of our studies, we tell some people, you know, human beings everywhere, we may look different, we may act different, but we all have a lot more in common than you might think. We are family, for those of you that are old enough to remember that very favorite bar mitzvah tune. All right. But the fact is that when we do that and then remind people of their mortality, they no longer hate people who are different. So I think the trick, and it may sound simple-minded, is how do we get people to recognize that we're all in this together. Moby Dick, I know many of you don't want to read a book that's long and it has Dick in the title, but nevertheless, Melville points out, you know, he has this beautiful metaphor where he's like, we're all in the boat and we all have the whale lines around our neck. And so if one of us goes down, the rest of us are also going down. Who remembers Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail where he says, you know, injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere. We're enmeshed in the same garment of mutual dependence. That may not have been true in antiquity, but it certainly is today. And I think you just make a good point. Whatever we need to do to engender the wholesale recognition that at the end of the day, our common humanity trumps all differences, I think we need to get there. I don't want to take up all our time, so anybody? All right, two more, and then hopefully we'll talk some more. Sir? Vodka, very good.
I just wanted to ask, sort of as a follow-up to that question, what would be your personal goals for what your research could accomplish?
Okay. Well, I mean, all right, good question. You know, at the risk, because I'm going to date myself, because I know some of the folks here are of my generation, you know, meaning I was educated in the last millennium, and this was like Woodstock, which was like the Enlightenment on mushrooms. And we grew up thinking that, as maybe naive as it sounds, when I was in graduate school, I was like, we got to figure out why people can't get along, because maybe if we can do that, we can take the edge. I'm not naive. We're not going to eliminate strife or prejudice. But if we can suck the death denial out of it, maybe we can make some headway. Similarly, I've always been preoccupied with why so many of my classmates when I was in school, why did they have so much trouble feeling good about themselves? And then I realized that, well, it's because we're taught to aspire for that which is unattainable. And so I guess if our research, I'm supposed to say, oh, I don't have any goals because we just want to advance the accumulation of knowledge. But Becker would have none of that. He insisted that it's our responsibility as sentient creatures to use what we learn to hopefully foster individual growth and social progress. And so even if that sounds a little corny, that's what I'd like to try and do. All right, one more.
Can you tell us a little more about this connection between the experience of dread and the move towards charismatic individuals? And how I mean, the way I understand dread is it sort of compresses, you know, self-interpretation as I am multidimensional, and then under dread, feeling it, I'm like cardboard, but charisma is sort of super personal or super individual. Can you talk about that?
No, because you just did. And you did very ably. So, you know, dread reduces complex individuals into quivering blobs of biological protoplasm, cowering under their chairs, groping for sedatives the size of sport utility vehicles. And when that happens, what we need are these larger-than-life figures that have a view of the world that is either black or white. I know where evil is. And if you support me, I will obliterate it. Again, not to sound highly political, but we do have an election coming up. Vote early, vote often. Look at the rhetoric coming out of one of the parties with people trying to see who will bomb somebody, anybody first. And soon it's going to be, I will bomb those people, and then I will bomb the rubble, and then I will vaporize the rubble. So I think the allure of charismatic leaders is just that. At times when we are most frightened and vulnerable, and all of us are prone to this, by the way, even if we'd like to think otherwise, I think that's how we become psychologically beholden to what appear to be larger-than-life powers. So good question, but you already knew the answer to that. Anyway, thank you so much. I think we need to move on, but thanks.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you liked what you heard, you might leave a good review. It'll help other listeners find us. Sheldon Solomon is the co-author, with Jeff Greenberg and Tom Pazinski, of The Worm at the Core, on the role of death in life. Solomon spoke at Smoke Farm Symposium 7 on Saturday, August 22nd, 2015. Tune in next week for another great talk. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.